Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, two men who dreamed of ending American slavery through radically different means. We'll spend this hour with historian H.W. Brands, whose new book is a dual biography of John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. Brown believed acts of violence and even murder were fair game if they advanced the cause of abolition, while Lincoln, who revered the U.S. Constitution, worried that Brown's terrorism would ultimately make it harder to achieve emancipation through legal means. We'll gain insight into how each man shaped history by considering what they did and what they failed to do. Our conversation starts after a short break. When the country you live in enables something truly evil, how does a good person decide what to do about it? In the case of the enslavement of millions of innocent men, women, and children over more than two centuries, John Brown and Abraham Lincoln took very different paths toward abolition, both of which would lead to the most destructive war in American history. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Brown's choice of methods, of course, included what today would be defined as terrorism, the murders of pro-slavery activists in Kansas in 1856, later the ill-fated raid on the federal armory at Harper's Ferry, which failed to produce the slave revolt Brown had hoped for. Lincoln put his faith in the Constitution and the processes of democracy, but neither on its own would liberate enslaved people without bloodshed. H.W. Brands is professor and Jack S. Blanton Sr. Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. He explores both these historic figures, their methods and their motivations, in his new book, The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. Bill, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Good to talk to you again.
So John Brown believed God had called him to take down the slave system that kept millions of people in bondage for generations. Was that call just like a feeling John Brown had, or did he believe he had directly heard the voice of God?
There's no particular indication that John Brown thought he was another Moses or anything like that who had direct communication. In fact, John Brown thought that God was calling every upright Christian to take up arms if necessary against slavery, but most of them did not, so John Brown had to do it for them. So he did believe that the Bible, Revelation, dictated action to free the slaves, to come to the aid of the oppressed, and he decided in midlife that this was his calling.
His childhood had laid the groundwork for this calling. Can you talk a little bit about that?
He grew up in Ohio, not too far from the Ohio River, which was the boundary at that time between the slave states and the free states. And as a consequence, he had exposure to slaves. He knew what enslaved people's lives were like. And as a kid, he really didn't think of it at all, except for one day, and he remembered this years later. He was playing with this black kid, a slave child, and the two were just playing as boys play. And in the middle of this, the master of the slave kid all of a sudden starts yelling at him and beating him over the head for no reason that John Brown could figure out. And all of a sudden it occurred to him, wait a minute, this other boy is very different than me. And it has to do with apparently maybe with the color of his skin, but more precisely his condition as a slave. And John Brown realized what that meant in a way that he hadn't before. And he also concluded there was something fundamentally wrong about this. So this set him on a course of thinking something is deeply wrong with slavery. Now that was a revelation for an individual. It was an attitude that was not universally shared in America of his day. So this is the first decade of the 19th century. Most Americans, even a lot of Americans, white Americans in the South, thought that slavery was some sort of evil, but it was just, in many cases, for the slave owners and for the South, it seemed to be a necessary evil. And many of them hoped, including many slaveholders, Henry Clay, Thomas Jefferson, hoped that it would go away. But over the course of time, in fact, over the course of John Brown's life, it didn't go away. Rather, it entrenched itself more thoroughly in the Southern economy, and it seemed to be fastening itself on the American Republic as a whole. And this was something that greatly alarmed John Brown and moved him to action ultimately.
Abraham Lincoln was born in a slave state. His father's reasons for disliking slavery, I guess, were partly moral, but also partly economic.
Yeah, so one of the reasons that people who lived in the vicinity of slave states were opposed to slavery was that it demeaned manual labor. And as part of that, it drove down the wage rate. And so a lot of people were opposed to slavery simply on, call it economic self-interest. And if the fact that it might have seemed immoral was on top of that, but at bottom it was the fact that a working man could not make a living if he had to compete with slaves.
So how did Lincoln's views against slavery deepen when he worked on a riverboat and went down to New Orleans?
So this is a critical moment in the individual lives of people who confront slavery, and really, in some ways, in the life of the nation as a whole. Because in those days, we're talking now about the first half of the 19th century, Americans didn't travel anywhere near as much as they would. And in the days before photography, in the days before television, they had no way of seeing what happened in the South. And only occasionally, when some other reason took a Northerner to the South, did they really confront the reality of slavery. Now, in the case of people who were heading west to dig for gold in California in the 1840s, many of them had to travel through Missouri. And for the first time, they were on the soil of a slave state. They would see a slave auction. Well, that's what happened to Abraham Lincoln. As a young man, he was hired to float a flatboat down to New Orleans. And, you know, slavery in the Deep South was very different from slavery in the Border South. As someone who had been born in Kentucky and then grown up in Indiana and Illinois, Lincoln was aware of slavery, but it wasn't the same thing, and it wasn't so much a part of the economy. And it appears to be the first time he had ever actually seen a slave auction in action. And the idea and then the sight of humans being sold and prodded and poked and examined just the way someone would examine a horse that he or she might be about to buy, it really caused Lincoln to think that this is a deeper wrong than I had realized.
So Frederick Douglass is not in the title, but he's also a significant character in this story. He would eventually be personally acquainted with both John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. Just because it's such a great story, will you remind us of how Douglass managed to gain his own freedom?
Douglass was a slave. He was an enslaved person in Maryland, and he was obviously a bright guy, and the fact that he lived in a border state and in a city made it a whole lot easier to contemplate escape. And so over time, he plotted how he would do this. He fell in love with a woman who assisted him in this, and he was able to make his escape just across the Mason-Dixon line into the North. Now, he did it before the slave issue became such a sensitive and divisive political issue as it had been before. Because if he had been born 10 years later, in order to accomplish his freedom, he probably would have had to go straight to Canada. Because by the 1850s, getting across the Ohio River or getting across the Mason-Dixon line or just getting out of a slave state into a free state no longer sufficed. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 compelled individuals and local authorities to assist in the return of escaped slaves. And so the only real freedom, the only assurance anybody would have was in Canada. You had to be outside the United States. And so it was Douglass's good fortune to be born before that happened. But even then, he was still legally a slave in Maryland. And his owner could reclaim him if he ever came south, if he ever came to Washington, D.C., for example. So he stayed away. And he had to watch out because slave catchers did go to the north. And if they could kidnap somebody and take him south, then they would. This became more difficult to do as he became very visible in the abolitionist community because he was sort of the abolitionist's dream. He was a former slave, so he knew whereof he spoke. Even as a slave, he had learned to read and write, and he was very articulate. He was a handsome man, a very arresting presence, and a powerful speaker. And so he could give the lie in his own person, by his own actions, to those people who said that slaves are inferior and they will never be the equal of white men. In fact, I mean, Frederick Douglass was more than the equal of most of the white people around him. And it's one of the reasons he seemed so threatening to people who were opposed to the abolitionists. But he cut such a figure that he went to London and he spoke to abolitionist groups there. And some people in England decided to get up, to take up a collection, to get enough money to pay Douglass's former owner. So, and then he sent the papers that indicated, okay, Douglass is a free man. Then after that, he could travel around more or less unworried that he would be snatched back into slavery. But for my purposes, he was crucial because I had already decided to write about John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. And they take these quite different positions on what to do about this thing they both agree is evil, slavery. But they never met. And so I needed a link between the two. Well, conveniently, Frederick Douglass did know John Brown and admired John Brown, did know Abraham Lincoln and admired Abraham Lincoln. And he also provides me as the author with this outside observer. I can tell the story of John Brown in his own words, sort of show the world as it looks to John Brown and then show the world as it looks to Abraham Lincoln. But I need sort of the world to look back at John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. And Frederick Douglass provides me that vantage.
So Brown and Douglass had very different views on using violence to end slavery. I mean, given that Douglass had suffered so much firsthand, why did he oppose Brown's violent agenda?
I think it was primarily on pragmatic grounds that violence wouldn't work. And the critical moment comes when John Brown, who for years had been sharing his ideas on how to combat slavery with Frederick Douglass, Brown is on the eve of launching the raid against Harper's Ferry, and he makes a point of inviting Douglass to come down for a meeting, and the two meet between where they happen to be living at the time. And Brown makes a personal pitch to Douglass saying, we need you to come along on this raid, on this attack. We are taking the war. We are taking the fight against slavery to the South, and we need you. And Brown understood that Douglass would provide immediate credibility because here's somebody who had been a slave and who'd become free, and now he's going back to help rescue other slaves. Brown knew that he was going to have credibility problems if here's this white guy who comes in to free the slaves. Why would any slave in his right mind in the vicinity of Harper's Ferry think that John Brown's plan is going to succeed? And Frederick Douglass says no. Basically, he said, I'm a writer, not a fighter. And further, he realized that John Brown's scheme was quite harebrained. It almost certainly could not succeed. And having escaped slavery once, Frederick Douglass wasn't going to put himself in a position where he might get captured and re-enslaved, or maybe worse, executed.
So John Brown had talked for years about wanting to adopt a black boy and raise him as his own son. That never happened. John Brown's plan to start a school to educate black children never happened. Was Brown always better at sort of hatching plans than executing them?
He was until, this is a harsh thing to say, until he adopted a code of violence. There's something about John Brown that wanted sort of immediate gratification. And the immediate gratification of being able to do something that is going to show something now, that is going to have a result now. And the whole idea of adopting a foster child or starting a school or something like this, the payoff would be years in coming. One of the reasons that John Brown became what amounted to a full-time abolitionist was he never succeeded well at anything else. He kept getting distracted. He had a short attention span. But once he had committed his life to the battle against slavery, and once he joined the battle, then he could really focus. In fact, it was hard to get, then he became something of a monomaniac on the subject.
My guest is H.W. Brands, professor and Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. His book is The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He is professor and Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is called The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. All right, Bill, Lincoln, of course, was personally opposed to slavery, but he very much wanted a career in politics. This was a hot button issue in his time. What sort of early bill did he draft in an effort to abolish slavery in Washington, D.C.? And what does that plan, although it never happened, tell us about his broader vision for achieving emancipation before anybody knew the Civil War would happen?
Lincoln's dream was that Southern slaveholders would be persuaded that it was in their economic and political self-interest to end slavery. He took the model of Massachusetts and New York and Pennsylvania, all the northern states that ended slavery for precisely those reasons. And he, along with a lot of other moderate opponents of slavery, believed that this was a viable proposition. His hero in politics, his model, what he called his beau ideal of a statesman, was Henry Clay, a slaveholder from Kentucky who had taken exactly this position. And so when Lincoln was a relatively young politician in Illinois, and then when he became a congressman in Washington in the 1840s, he drafted a bill to end slavery in the District of Columbia. And he would do this by offering the slave owners compensation for their property, very much in the way that if the federal government wanted to expand the wing of the Capitol and it had to claim the property of a private landowner next door, it would pay that person. And it was in the national interest or in the public interest to do this. And Lincoln contended that compensation to slaveholders would be in the public interest. And he recognized something crucial about this, and that was that, moral issues aside, slavery was a huge economic factor in the Southern economy. And to ask a slave owner to simply free his or her slaves, ask them to essentially abandon the most valuable asset they had. Plenty of slave owners simply couldn't have afforded to do that if they had wanted to. Thomas Jefferson never freed his slaves during his lifetime, in large part because they were collateral for the debts that Jefferson owed. So this idea of compensated emancipation, it seemed to Lincoln to be a way of squaring that circle. And he figured that it would be relatively inexpensive, considering what the alternatives might eventually be, for the federal government to pay off the slaveholders, because it might avert, eventually war, and would be a whole lot cheaper to do. Lincoln's proposal didn't get support from the slaveholders. They didn't want to give up their property, and it's certainly not at the order of the federal government. Interestingly enough, it also met resistance among abolitionists, who thought that it was simply morally wrong to acknowledge a property right in humans that compensation would entail.
What limitations did Lincoln find in the Constitution on the ability of the federal government to outright ban slavery all at once?
Well, Lincoln was an originalist regarding the Constitution in the sense of interpreting the Constitution as this positive charter. And if the Constitution does not grant to the federal government a power explicitly, then the federal government does not have that power. And there's nothing in the Constitution that says that the federal government can end slavery in the states. And it was clearly understood by everybody at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and every generation of lawyer and politician afterwards that the understanding was that the states get to keep slavery as long as they want. It's a domestic institution, and the federal government has no control over those domestic institutions. Now, the exceptions were the parts of the United States that were not states. So the District of Columbia is not a state, and therefore Congress could legislate for or against slavery in the District of Columbia. Likewise, in the federal territories in the West, Congress could legislate for or against slavery there, Lincoln thought.
So this book is a lot about how there were compromises in the years leading up to the Civil War that really weren't satisfactory to either side. Why was the compromise of 1850 particularly egregious on both sides?
Because by 1850, both sides were prepared to be aggrieved. Hmm. Northerners were surprised that the influence of white Southerners, in particular the slaveholding aristocracy, was as great as it still was. They had looked and they had seen that the population of the North and of the West had outstripped the South dramatically. But the South, in particular, this slaveholding class in the South, still wielded a veto over the federal government. And this just didn't seem right. They felt that the slaveholders had way too much power compared to their numbers. And they were right in that regard, if one believed in democracy in the sense of one person, one vote. On the other hand, Southerners felt that they were being surrounded and that they were being criticized in the most moral terms. They were being dealt with as sinners and evil persons. And their response to this was, in some cases, it was to say, look, we didn't invent slavery. We inherited slavery. And we're doing the best we can to manage this institutions. Now, as the abolitionist rhetoric grew in intensity, some went even farther than that. John C. Calhoun, senator from South Carolina, became famous or notorious for declaring slavery not to be a necessary evil, as the generation of the Constitution had believed, but slavery was a positive good, he said. It uplifted the African people, made them Christians, and all this other good stuff. It was good not simply for the whites, but for the blacks as well.
Wow.
And so that was an extreme version, but by 1850, the South felt it was beleaguered. It was outnumbered, and the North was conspiring to deprive it of its property rights. The attitude of Southerners, Southern slaveholders regarding slaves, this was a property right, was no less emotional than the attitude of many supporters today of gun rights, who say, you know, I'm going to hold on to my guns, and anything that deprives me of my right to bear arms is simply wrong. And not only is it wrong, it's a threat to my very existence. And then in the case of the slaveholders, one of the things that worried them all the time was the possibility of a slave uprising. Because in places like South Carolina as a state, in other parts of other states, slaves in some cases greatly outnumbered the whites. And if slaves ever got it in their heads to rebel, as they did occasionally, more spectacularly in places like Haiti, they could rise up, they could murder the slave owners in their beds, and you know, they could take over at least part of the state. And this was the nightmare of people in the South. And every time an abolitionist put thoughts in the head of slaves that you should be free, you ought to be free, you must be free, Southerners could construe that as, this is a threat against my very life.
So it was a nightmare for people in the South, white people. It was a dream for people like John Brown. I want to talk about Pottawatomie. He organized this raid on a pro-slavery white settlement in Kansas. How did he choose the particular victims that would die that night?
It's a little bit unclear. John Brown had been talked into going to Kansas by several of his adult sons. Kansas became a battleground between pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces following the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which repealed an important provision of the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which had said that Kansas and Nebraska and the rest of the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase should be ever free territory. Slavery should never be allowed there. But Stephen Douglas, senator from Illinois, Lincoln State, decided that he was going to reopen the issue. He had a variety of reasons. One was he wanted to get a railroad built to the West Coast, and it would have its eastern terminus in Chicago for Illinois' benefit. But also, Douglas was trying to figure out how to bridge the gap between the northern branch of the Democratic Party and the southern branch of the party so that he could become the party's presidential nominee and become president. Anyway, the Kansas-Nebraska Act opens Kansas up to settlement by both slaveholding settlers and settlers who oppose slavery. And the idea was that when Kansas Territory had a population large enough to warrant writing a state constitution, then whoever had the majority there would write the constitution either for or against slavery. So the race was on for Kansas. And John Brown's elder sons, having been schooled in anti-slavery thinking by their father, said, we're heading off to Kansas. And they said to their dad, you ought to come too. And so he did. John Brown got out there, and he was frustrated. He was actually very dismayed by the inability or the unwillingness of the anti-slavery forces to stand up to what he considered to be the egregious behavior of the pro-slavery groups. And they basically destroyed an anti-slavery settlement of Lawrence, Kansas. And John Brown thought, these pro-slavery brigands, they need to be taught a lesson. And the lesson that he decided to teach them was, you can't get away with this. Now, he didn't pick on any people that were specifically connected to any particular actions. What he wanted to do was to send a political message that Kansas is not safe territory for people who support slavery. So he and a small group, including a couple of his sons, one dark night, descended on this hamlet along Pottawatomie Creek. And they pulled five pro-slavery settlers out of their beds, away from their wives and families, and hacked them to death with broadswords.
So there are extant photos of John Brown even today. He was quite a striking person to look at. How did he manage to escape capture after Pottawatomie?
Ah, the key is that those photographs were not available in that day. At least they weren't easily reproducible. So there was, first of all, there was no such thing as an FBI. There was no federal law enforcement agency. That was actually important. But in addition, nobody had a good image of John Brown. There were descriptions. Okay, so he's this guy, and he has these arresting blue eyes, and he has close-cropped hair and no beard. Well, of course, the first thing he did was to grow a beard and to let his hair grow long, and he would operate under assumed names. And it turned out that John Brown was a consummate actor, and so he could pretend that he was a harmless surveyor, and he could just, you know, do whatever he was going to do, and people would pay him no mind. When he wanted to establish a base for the raid on Harper's Ferry, he presented himself as a guy who was a farmer, basically, who was going to buy cattle and then resell the cattle. So he needed a place to fatten up the cattle before they went to market. And unless you were really attuned to be on the lookout for John Brown, you think this was just some old backcountry farmer. And he was engaging. He could be. He could small talk when he needed to. Now, that really wasn't his style. But as I say, he could pull this kind of thing off. Now, I guess it's important to remember that, I mean, I wrote a book about John Brown, so I'm focusing on John Brown. And we remember John Brown. But before Harper's Ferry, almost nobody knew about John Brown. Yes, there were federal charges that said he was involved with these murders. But as I said, nobody knew how to connect this individual with those murders. And even if they had, there's no FBI to call. So most people just didn't consider this to be a foremost issue. They weren't on the lookout for John Brown.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We have Tracy calling from South Carolina. Hi, Tracy.
Yes, hi. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Yes, I was calling. I was just saying I did watch the show. I believe it was on Netflix or one of those sites. At any rate, it was the movie about John Brown. And also, I'm just talking about, I'm thinking about how we revive history, or how one side looks at a person in history. We look at John Brown, and they talk about him and what he stood for, and, you know, he's kind of drawn up to be a kind of slightly crazy character out of his mind. You know, if he was inspired by God, he was hearing things, he was seeing things. But then if we have John C. Calhoun or Andrew Jackson, who, you know, the images that we see of them, they kind of all look like brothers. One is just aggressive and determined, whereas the other is crazy and you know, a fanatic. So, you know, it's just interesting how we look back at some characters from one side or the other. And I also feel like, you know, John Brown, he was really what he saw was he saw the inhumanity of humans.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much for calling. Bill, was John Brown crazy?
No, John Brown was not crazy. John Brown, in fact, was in some ways the sanest person around. He was an extremist in his views on slavery, an extremist for his time, extreme in the sense of believing that the inhumanity, as Tracy says, of slavery justified almost any response, no matter how violent. But to say that John Brown was crazy, it was convenient, actually, for people like Abraham Lincoln to say that John Brown was crazy. Because as soon as the Harper's Ferry raid took place, and John Brown was seen as this man who's trying to launch a servile rebellion, a rebellion of slaves, that's going to shake the South and free all the slaves, the anti-slavery party, the new anti-slavery party, the Republicans, they do everything they can to distance themselves from John Brown. And Abraham Lincoln says, John Brown is not a Republican. And Republicans, most of them said, I'm not an abolitionist. They made a sharp distinction between abolitionists. These were ones who say that slavery must be ended immediately, no matter the cost. And people like, well, most Republicans, like Abraham Lincoln said, yes, slavery must be ended, but we can't destroy American democracy in doing it. Because if we destroy American democracy, then the freedoms of everybody will be at risk.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org. If you want to find us on Twitter, you can leave a message at @KERAThink. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He is professor and Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about his new book, The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He is professor and Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. There's a lot in the book about the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which I didn't realize were called the Douglas-Lincoln debates until much later in history, Bill. But Lincoln argued that slavery was wrong in part because it encouraged interracial sexual relationships. It's a pretty abhorrent argument to modern audiences. But to be clear, Lincoln always believed the only proper way forward for the country would be to permanently separate white and black people, right?
This was a big problem for moderate opponents of slavery. It had been a problem for Thomas Jefferson, who likewise had said, you know, I can't figure out basically what to do with the freed slaves after we free them, because he had never seen, Abraham Lincoln had never seen, arguably no one has ever seen, a functioning democracy that was fully biracial and equal to all parties. And they lived at a time when American democracy had a hard enough time working with just the white people. And to inject into that a bunch of black people who had come not of their own volition and who were despised by many of the whites, and for very good reason, probably hated many of the whites in return, they just couldn't get their heads around how that would work. The other thing was, one of the biggest fears, again, of the Southern slave owners was, well, if the slaves are freed, then all of a sudden we are going to be outnumbered in our own counties, in our own communities by black people. So it was partly as a result of his own concerns about democracy, but also as a way of signaling to Southerners that I understand your concern. So if, how about this deal? What if we free the slaves and then pack them all off to Africa? Or South America, or really any place, the West Indies, any place outside the United States. The problem with that was that the slaves were more American than certainly many of recent immigrants, and they had, most of them, and since the slave trade from Africa had been ended, at least legally, in the first decade of the 19th century, none of them were Africans. They were all Americans, and they didn't want to go. Furthermore, most people in Africa wouldn't know what to do with them either.
All right. To John Brown's plan to seize the federal armory at Harper's Ferry, seizing the armory was one thing. It wasn't very heavily defended. What made him think this particular act would incite the kind of slave uprising that he had dreamed of?
Well, to give John Brown the benefit of the doubt, his plan was basically this. He would demonstrate by showing that some slaves could escape with his assistance. The reason he chose Harper's Ferry was there was an arsenal, a batch of weapons there that he could readily circulate among the slaves. But in addition, it was in the mountains, and it was in a part of the South, basically the mountains that ran from the South up into Pennsylvania and the North, that the slaves could basically take refuge in the mountains, where they'd be hard to find and hard to root out. And then they would eventually make their way to Canada. But the idea that slaves could escape all of a sudden would make slaves less valuable to slave owners, because if there's a risk of losing your property, then your slave all of a sudden isn't worth anywhere near as much. And that would make slavery unprofitable in the South, and it would encourage Southern slave owners to say, okay, enough, we'll give up our slaves. Now, that's putting the best face on it. In reality, John Brown was quite willing for thousands of slaves to take up arms and defend their freedom by killing their masters if necessary.
How many people showed up?
Volunteers are the people who were dragooned.
I mean, well, yeah.
John, the cadre of people who voluntarily followed John Brown into Harper's Ferry was about 20. And there were some others who were sent out into the outlying regions precisely to try to generate support among the slaves. And almost none of them, none of whom responded, at least not willingly. Some of them were kind of talked into it or had their arms twisted to come. But the idea was that, yeah, the surprise attack. Nobody was expecting that this arsenal would be attacked, and so it was very lightly defended. They arrived in the dead of night. People had seen John Brown in the neighborhood, but they didn't realize he was John Brown. He was just this guy, and here he comes, and they take over the very lightly guarded arsenal. But the thing started falling apart all at once, partly starting from the fact that he didn't get the response that he wanted from the enslaved folks in the neighborhood. But secondly, now, he should have thought of this. John Brown had no military training to speak of at all. He had read military books. But the first thing he should have noticed is that Harper's Ferry is easy to get into, really hard to get out of, because you have to go out along rivers or climb mountain ridges or something. And so as soon as they took over the arsenal, which required some gunshots went off, so it woke up the people in the town. And it didn't take long for them to realize that they were under attack. They didn't know who it was by. They didn't know that this was the guy who was wanted for murder in Kansas. It was just somebody who was trying to take over the arsenal and stir up trouble among the slaves. And so when the townspeople wake up and they decide to respond, then it's really easy to pin John Brown and his band in the engine house of the arsenal. And so they spend a day where basically they're fending off attack. The militia from the outside are taking pot shots at them, and they're getting hit every now and then, but they're able to hold on until Robert E. Lee of the United States Army, still at the time, arrives with a bunch of Marines. And in short order, Lee orders an assault on the engine house, and several of the surviving people are killed. John Brown escapes death because the sword of one of the officers leading the charge, he grabbed whatever was near, because he was told, you got to get off to Harper's Ferry quickly. He grabbed a sword that turned out to be a ceremonial sword rather than the real deal. And when he took a swipe at Brown's head, it bent over his head. It left him a nasty-looking scalp wound, but nothing that was at all lethal.
The story of Brown's son's death is really hard for me to get my head around. It sounds like Brown is very cold and uncaring. Can you put that in context for me?
So, yeah, I had to deal with that too. So John Brown is in the engine house, and one of his sons is dying. And John Brown lifts almost not a finger and seems not to pay any attention to this. And the best I can come up with is, and this because in other contexts, John Brown was an affectionate father. Now, affectionate, but his sons lived in fear of him as well. He was a very demanding figure. He was this powerful presence. And one of the hardest things I had to try to figure out was, what was the secret of his charisma? Because he won people over. He convinced people to do things, Frederick Douglass accepted. He convinced people to do things that they wouldn't have done otherwise. But the best I can come up with is that John Brown said, okay, once we go to battle, then my sons are no different than any other soldiers. And we have all decided that our lives are forfeit if necessary. And so his dying son just became, you know, a little bit more collateral damage.
All right, let's go back to the phones. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Matthew is calling us from Texas. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guest mentioned earlier that John Brown tried to enlist Frederick Douglass to go with him to, because it would lend immediate, you know, support to the cause. My question is, like, a slave on a plantation, how aware were they of Frederick Douglass and who he was and what he had accomplished? In my mind, you know, they wouldn't know that much outside of the plantation. So I'm just curious about that answer.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling.
Actually, that's a really good question, a really good response to what I had said. Yeah. So most of them wouldn't have known. By 1859, Southern slave owners did their level best to make sure that the slaves in particular, but also the rest of the white population in the South, didn't read any abolitionist literature, didn't even know that there was such a thing as an abolitionist movement. But the fact that there would be this articulate, clearly well-educated former slave, along with John Brown, the mere fact that he was there would tend to say that this guy isn't a lunatic, as he was soon charged with being, and that this is something that you could really do. But this is an excellent point in that it's easy to sort of read back to this time and think, oh, Frederick Douglass was this towering figure. Well, actually, most of Frederick Douglass's fame came in the 1860s and 1870s. He was known in abolitionist circles, but abolitionists in the 1850s were seen in among many people, even in the North, as sort of like communists in the 1950s. These were people who, okay, I mean, communists, maybe they have egalitarian ideas, but they have some really strange practices. And if we follow them, this is going to lead the country to destruction. So Frederick Douglass was not the world famous figure, certainly on plantations in the South, that it might be easy to think that he was.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What did Brown have to say after he was tried and convicted and sentenced to death?
Basically, he said that the South is going to have to reckon with slavery. The country is going to have to reckon with slavery. And his final words were actually scribbled onto a note that he handed to his jailer as he was on his way to the gallows. And he said that the evil of slavery will not be purged from this land except by blood. Now, at the time, this was a bold, a very sort of extreme statement to make. But when the Civil War began, just 2 years later, then it was tempting to see John Brown as this prophet. In fact, who was also a martyr, who had been killed for his beliefs and who had prophesied the war that was going to be required to end slavery.
You note at the end of the book that Frederick Douglass would always perceive Lincoln to be the white man's president, despite Lincoln's actions to eliminate slavery in the United States. Douglass said, this is a quote, "We are at best only his stepchildren, children by adoption, children by forces of circumstances and necessity." Is that a fair assessment?
It's probably fair from Douglass's emotional standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And Douglass, at the outbreak of the Civil War, told Lincoln again and again, this is a war about slavery. And Lincoln said, no, it's not. This is a war about the Union. And for the first year and a half of the war, Lincoln sternly took the position that this war is not about slavery. It's about preserving the Union. He said, you know, I've taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, not to abolish slavery. Now, Lincoln had to deal with the reality that there were four slave states strategically located that had not left the Union. And if Lincoln said this is a war against slavery, the first thing that would have happened is the federal government would have had to evacuate Washington because it would have been surrounded by slave territory. And the second thing, if the United States couldn't hold Kentucky and Missouri and Maryland, it probably couldn't hold the South at all. So Lincoln was playing a long game. Lincoln believed that, yeah, possibly we could free slaves 6 months sooner, but the long-term cost would be far greater. And it's hard to know who was right in this debate, because the war did end by ending slavery, but the subsequent nearly century of the Jim Crow system of legalized and extra-legal oppression in the South, including lynchings and everything else, indicated, made very clear that emancipation had been imposed on the South. It was Lincoln's hope that the South would be persuaded into ending slavery, not coerced into ending slavery. And it's possible to imagine an alternative scenario where the South, let's suppose there's no civil war, let's suppose there's no secession. If we're imagining, we might as well imagine a lot. But if the South ended slavery of its own accord, then South Carolina might not have been any different than New York post-slavery or Pennsylvania post-slavery. As an interesting thought experiment, basically every country in the world allowed slavery in 1800. In 1900, essentially no country in the world allowed slavery. It's really only in the United States, and with a partial exception of Haiti, that ending slavery required a bloodbath. In the case of the United States, 700,000 people died in the American Civil War. So it was tempting after the fact to think that somehow the war was necessary to end slavery. It was Lincoln's hope until the moment the war started that that wasn't going to be the case.
H.W. Brands is professor and Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. His newest book is The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for spending this hour with us.
The pleasure is mine, Chris. Best to you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, go to wherever you get your podcast and type KERA Think in the search bar, or listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.